Good afternoon and welcome to our meeting. It's 1:30 p.m. on July 16th, 2024, and time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUB Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today are Commissioner Tony Olson, our Vice President, Commissioner Rebecca Wolf, our Secretary, John Harlow, our CEO, Colin Willenbrock, our General Counsel. Joining virtually is Melissa Collins, our Commission Executive Services Director, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, and joining virtually also is Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and then we have Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please turn off or mute your cell phones or electronic devices. Copies of the agenda are located on the Deputy Clerk's board table near the entrance. Commissioners, are there any items to be added or changes to be made to the published agenda?
Yes. Agenda item 2A, General Manager's Lifesaving Award, has been stricken from today's agenda and rescheduled for the August 6th meeting.
Thank you. Comments from the public is item 3 on today's agenda, and that's when the board will hear comments for items that are not listed on today's agenda. Comments will be limited to 5 minutes, and persons shall be recognized to speak from the sign-up cards located on the Deputy Clerk's table near the entrance. You're joining by Zoom, click raise hand, or dial *9 if by phone, and I will call on you to speak at the appropriate time. This meeting is being recorded. When addressing the board during the meeting, please step up to the podium, use the microphone, state and spell your name and indicate where you are from. Please remain at the podium while you speak and address the commissioners and not the audience. If you have documents or other materials to enter in the record, please hand them to the deputy clerk, who will distribute them to the board. We appreciate your cooperation with our procedures. Please note that all actions receive an automatic silent second from the board. This ensures that all issues can be brought to the floor for discussion. So we'll start off with our flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America,
to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Item 1 on our agenda today is our General Manager briefing and study session. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. We have one item for the study session this afternoon, and that is our snowclad reliability for 2023. David Popich and Soren Woman present. Good afternoon, Soren.
Hi. So yeah, my name is Soren Wellman. I work for Snohomish PUD. I'm a distribution protection engineer working for the System Planning and Protection Department. And with me is David Popich. He's also a distribution protection engineer. Dave covers the north area. I cover the east area. So kind of going out, those are a lot of the areas you're gonna hear from today, or you'll hear about today. And we present this every year. So, are we presenting these slides? Oh, yeah. I'm not getting any response here. Okay. There we go. Sorry about that. So first of all, as usual, I'm just going to do a quick refresher of some of the reliability index definitions that we use. The first three are industry standard terms, SAIDI, CAIDI, and CAIFI. SAIDI, that's the System Average Interruption Duration Index, basically measures how many minutes a customer is out of power from us. And that is calculated for however we want those numbers to be used. So for most of these presentations, for these first three metrics, we're going to be talking about system SAIDI. So when you hear 87 minutes saved, that's on average for all of our customers. But it can be calculated for individual substations, can be calculated for individual circuits, laterals, whatever gives us some value for doing that. So next is CAIDI, that represents the average time to restore service when a customer has lost power for a non-momentary outage. And SAIDI is the system average interruption frequency index that indicates how often the average customer experiences a sustained outage. So both of those, again, could be evaluated on a system-wide level, a substation level, circuit level, and beyond. The last one is major event day, and that's used to define a 24-hour period which Sadie experiences exceeds a certain threshold, which is based on an IEEE standard. So that kind of allows us to normalize data sets, especially looking from year to year, and it's a retroactive metric. And so you'll commonly, you'll hear Dave and I will refer to these as they often happen during storms, which is a clarification that because a storm order is issued, we don't necessarily know that will be, that storm will become a major event day until we look at it from a 24-hour period. So when ECC is issuing a storm order, they don't know or aren't really looking at, is this really gonna be a major event day? That's something that Dave and I's group would look at when we get a daily outage report or when we're looking at past data. So so first let's look at the, I'll kind of go through some of the data and I'll show for the last year, the last calendar year, and then I'll look at kind of how we've used that to make some decisions and some improvements. The first is this graph, which shows Sadie, Katie, and Kafee for 2023, and that's kind of in the dark blue, and you can compare that to the previous year, 2022, as well as a five-year average, five-year rolling average of the last 5 years. So you can see Sadie and Katie, as well as Safi, they went down compared to last year, and there was a reduction in comparison to the rolling five-year average as well. We did see an increase to the rolling five-year average for Safi, but it's generally pretty close. So where we see a big deviation though is in 2023 we had zero major event days. That's a big outlier for us, and you can just see that looking at the past couple of years, and including it kind of has a big effect on our metrics. So what this graph shows is that the total Sadie for 2023, some of the worst days of the previous year for 2022 came close to matching those entire minutes. So we have 3 days where we're essentially matching 365 days of Sadie. We have three of those years last year. And it kind of shows like how much of an impact a major event day has on our system. It just creates huge swings for yearly reliability data. And they're essentially these big metrics, they're all weather pattern related. So they may or may not reflect, when we look at Sadie, it may or may not reflect how well engineering, maintenance, construction efforts have gone over the last several months. And that's something that, you know, this year we've seen as well. So we've issued 9 storm work orders for 2024. We were, you know, comparing last year, we're kind of have higher Sadie this year compared to last year. And a big part of that is we just haven't had the weather events that have triggered that. So,
yeah, I need to go ahead.
Why are major storms calculated in this?
Well, so
doesn't it skew it?
So that's a major event day allows us to take those really bad storms based on the IEEE metric out of Sadie, out of our yearly Sadie calculation. So we may have a storm that rides right up to that line. It's basically, it's a black and white decision based on the standard. And it's just a kind of plug and play calculation. It's a black and white line that maybe you have something that crosses that line. You're allowed to exclude that out, but you may have a really bad storm that does not hit that minutes thing and that we do have to include it. So, so we may have a storm that plays a big factor in a yearly SADA for one day, but it may not be bad enough to be considered a major event day. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
It's an attempt to try to normalize, to pull out the major events and normalize to the extent possible when you are calculating SAIDI to include storms. Some companies, and we've actually talked about this, to actually have a storm SAIDI and a blue sky SAIDI, because you can do, you know, some work with both to figure out how to improve reliability. But it's just an industry standard way to normalize. The other thing, though, to note, if you take the big storm that we had in November, what, of 22, that's not all days of that storm. That was probably three or four. I think that was a seven-day storm. That's probably two, three, maybe 4 days. The other days that would still have a significantly high SAIDI wouldn't meet the threshold for a major event day. So there's still some of that residual that is built into those numbers and that are a part of what SAIDI we are measuring.
So far this year, we've had several storm days. None of those triggered what we would call a major event day, which would allow us to take that data out of this year's SAIDI, 2024 SAIDI. So if you kind of line up where we are with SAIDI from a calculation perspective, this year looks a lot worse so far than 2022. But if you ask the customer what their experience is, 2022 had some really bad major event days, which you can see on the graph. So from a customer experience, 2022 would be a worse year. I mean, any customer would take 2024, but when you take those out, the customer, the data, that sort of industry standard data that we look at, we would technically say that 2024 so far has had better SAIDI.
So, Soren, if going back to the previous graphic, all of that, those days we just looked at, they're taken out of this, those major event days.
That's correct.
Okay, so this is progress we made in a year or relative to our average.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, with that taken out.
That would be our status. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's my thought. I just.
Yeah. And so for this graph, if it were to include major event days, 2022 would be probably on the second or third floor of this building. It's up there. So.
I get it.
Yeah. And to Soren's point, and we've even seen this in our J.D. Power results, right? People remember the storms, especially the customers that happen to be restored in that third, fourth, fifth, and beyond date. Typical, you know, blue sky or even the smaller storms where we're still getting most of the folks back on in 24, at worst case, 48 hours, that's a much different customer experience than somebody that's been without power greater than that 48-hour threshold.
So we improved our safety and our KD over last year.
Mm-hmm. Actually, all three of them.
Great.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
So that's kind of not, I guess those are sort of our general statistics for the last, comparing last year to both 2022 and our rolling average, but kind of to dig a little bit deeper into the data and how that influences our decisions, we have a graph here of some of the circuits that were outliers in performance. And so these are individual circuits on individual substations. And so what we're showing here is the relationship between circuit length and circuit SAIDI. So this is individual circuit SAIDI, not system SAIDI. And as a circuit is, for longer circuits, there's a lot more exposure to potential incidents, cars hitting poles, trees falling on lines, whatever type of problem we have, the bigger a circuit is, the more problems we would expect to see on that. And so therefore, we would expect the longer a circuit is, the higher the SAIDI is in general. And most of this data follows the red dashed line. That's kind of our trend line. Most of the data follows that, but us in system protection, we want to look at like where are some problem areas that may have kind of simple solutions. So there's five circuits. Our group has looked at each of these that are kind of identified as outliers. We're just showing the worst five. The top two are in the east, so that would be my area. And so I ended up looking at each of these. So the first one is Turner's Corner 1429. And kind of what we saw is there were two really, really, really long outages on this circuit that started pretty close to the feeder. They just had very long repair times. So there wasn't a whole lot of opportunity for improvement. They were both between the circuit breaker and the first recloser. They both involved fallen poles. There's a lot of time out for just two outages. Whereas when I looked at Lake Chaplin 2036, there was a lot of outages. And that actually triggered the launching and approval and completion of several unspecified projects. So I've launched four unspecified projects on this circuit and one right next to this circuit. That's actually on a Woods Creek circuit that they sometimes offload to each other. All but one of those projects has been completed, and we would expect that, like, there to be a lot of improvement as these goes on. And so just because a circuit is on this list does not mean that that's an automatic trigger to spend money to fixing it, but it's something that we look at in conjunction with daily outage reports that we review weekly, event files, reports from our servicemen in service territories, reports from key customers. So all of that type of data, or all of those inputs, go into us potentially launching a project. So
if you go back to that data, so then I realize these are on here because they pop out on SAIDI, but the couple of safeties are really startling. You zapped.
So safety.
How do we integrate the two numbers into maybe the choices we make about?
So yeah, so with the safety, the safety on the Turner's Corner, you can see it's pretty low. So customers only experience on average two outages.
Right. So that's the sevens, yeah.
So yeah, and so that's something that we would say, like, okay, well, when I looked into the data, there were two just incredibly long outages. And I think one involved a pole that had completely fallen and had to be reset, and there was no way to backfeed. Generally, when we see bad safety, we would look at, and we'd say, okay, well, what's the safety? Is there a lot of outages?
Right.
Okay, there's a lot of outages. How can we potentially sectionalize that circuit? And that's exactly what happened with Lake Chaplin. So,
I guess if you could have a high safety on this circuit one year and a low on another year, right? Potentially.
Yeah.
It's just a lot of random bad luck.
Yeah, and so the opposite, that would normally correspond to a lot of lateral outages. And lateral outages, because they're on laterals, they're isolated. They're generally, you don't get as much bang for your buck, speaking in terms of, like, seeking solutions. And you may also be very limited in what you can do. So, whereas with feeder, there's typically a lot more options. And Dave will talk about some of those.
I would mention there's a customer experience, customer satisfaction element to this.
That's what I was thinking, if, like, we're going out 7.5 times a year.
Yeah. Exactly. And a good example of that is on underground cable.
Yeah.
Maybe a small number of customers, but if you have a cable fall, you know, 3-4 times in a year, that's annoying. And those are typically, can be, especially if it's a radial feed, longer outages.
Yeah.
So it's not just about chasing those numbers or improving the SAIDI and SAIDI numbers, it's also about improving the customer experience. So you go out and replace that cable or inject the cable, do whatever you need to do to solve those outages.
Okay.
It's not as cost effective as Soren had mentioned to reduce the overall SAIDI or safety numbers, but it is the right thing to do for our customers.
Yeah. And another point on that is just when we have the big thing in the East is when we have outages that are very far away from our service centers. So that's where it's, that's kind of what is something that I take into consideration as well.
Sure.
Is it going to take a serviceman? You know, there's a lot of places where you have circuits going over rivers out you know, near Monroe, Bilgar, and to completely patrol the line, and servicemen have to drive, you know, 20 miles or something to go, they can't get access. So.
Well, first thing, that should improve with the new Arlington Center being closer to these areas that are outlines.
Potentially, yes. I'm not super familiar. That's in Dave's area, but maybe you can.
Yeah, not so much. I mean, you're talking about the new Arlington Service Center.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that serves the north part of our county or our service area in Sorens.
Oh, these are out east,
yeah.
Northeast.
Yeah, correct.
Okay, so let's see. My other question. Where you have length, that's miles, right?
Right.
So what about topography? You mentioned a river. Rivers, other, like, if it's really hilly or steep, or topography would be an issue too, wouldn't it?
Yes, we don't have a great metric for that, but it's definitely something I've noticed. There's some areas near Woods Creek where sometimes when you get really bad snow and ice, a serviceman can't even get to where the fault is. So they can isolate, but they may not be able to switch other customers back in or even repair the faulted areas. So yeah, that's out in the east and also North Mountain area. I mean, it's can be
tricky. So straight miles are different from.
No, I think this is just considering just the miles of wire.
Okay.
This wouldn't be necessarily miles driven to fix a problem.
Okay. Thank you.
So what are we doing? I guess is kind of probably the next question. On the transmission side, so the 115 kV side, we've implemented 7 new or upgraded auto sectionalizing and auto transfer schemes in 2023. We trimmed 340 miles of circuit. We completed the Three Lakes to Sky Valley feeder tie, which is going to provide us more flexibility when there's faults open. The Three Lakes area, which is exactly one of those locations where it's hilly, treaty, lots of waterways, whatnot. We completed the first phase of the Sky Valley substation, which is now online, which gives us a lot of flexibility. It also it reduces the number of customers on each circuit out in the Woods Creek area. So now when you have a circuit go offline, instead of 2,500 customers, maybe we have 600. And just gives us a lot more flexibility in switching. And we've completed a handful of unspecified projects. Last year we installed or updated 22 reclosers, which is double what we did in 2022 and double what we did in 2021. So we've been pretty busy with that. We've been rolling out single phase reclosers. Which their primary purpose is fire mitigation, but they also have a reliability benefit. And we also completed a reliability project on South Camino where we installed 7 gang-operated switches, which greatly enhanced the flexibility of servicemen to respond to faults and put customers back in service before making repairs to down wire poles. So, and will actually touch on it.
Hello. So to go off what Soren there was saying, we use switching to isolate damaged parts of circuits. With multiple switches and ties to other circuits, we're able to reconfigure circuits and restore customers. Reclosers automatically interrupt fault current, and so that also isolates damaged parts of circuits. We can also manually operate reclosers to if it's an advantage to restore customers. So in 2023, we used manual switching to reduce SAIDI for 294 outages, while reclosers reduced SAIDI for 85 outages. Combined, we saved 87 minutes from those two. So that's 80% of our 2023 system minutes that were reduced. Auto-sectionalizing and auto-transfer scheme reduced SAIDI for 6 transmission outages. So you can see that manual switching and auto-reclosing remains to be our most effective strategies for improving reliability. These two strategies are very important to remember and understand when we talk about SnowSmart later on a later slide. SnowSmart will basically amplify and improve these two strategies. And eventually, with a system built out and with years of testing and training under our belt, we're going to be able to basically have the same capability we have on our transmission with the auto sectionalizing, but on a distribution level.
So when we have a power restore quickly because of is automatic equipment, does that calculate into the safety, or is safety, the power have to be out for a certain number of minutes for us to count it as an incident?
So it's not going to necessarily reflect on the safety because we consider an outage after a minute.
Okay, minute.
So
thanks.
The safety is the one you'll see the improvement on, and the KD. We utilize strategic priorities that are developed by the leadership team to help guide and justify our projects. Our current major projects fall under priority one, which is to which is bolstering operational reliability and resiliency. So we've recently improved our tree trimming priority list, which falls in line with initiative 1.2B to develop and implement grid hardening policies and practices resilient to climate change impacts. We're working on outage location specific projects that falls in line with initiative 1.2C, increase the value and impacts of our reliability and resiliency improvement work with more sophisticated planning and new approaches. And of course, the much anticipated SnowSmart project, our secure, modern, automated, and reliable technology project, tongue twister, falls directly in line with initiative 1.2D to implement and distribution automation capabilities, leveraging smart grid communication infrastructure. I'll go into detail on these three on the next slides. So this table here shows our top 10 circuits and substations and their contribution to system safety. Key change that we've made in 2023 is that this data now is only looking at tree-caused outages. So any kind of carpools or maybe a substation fault has now been excluded, and we're just looking at tree outages. Another key change is looking at system safety versus the individual circuit or substation safety. So this should better strategize where our tree trimming efforts will have the most impact. And additionally, we're gonna focus on main feeder over laterals because of outage on our feeder has a much bigger impact to our customers. A lot more customers are affected for a feeder outage. And so this is more of our reliability trimming. Note that we're still doing all of our safety trimming. This is more of, if we have additional resources, where how would we strategize to see the best improvement in reliability? Additionally, our vegetation management group made improvements to our notification process, which became a challenge during COVID, and then remained a challenge where customers were not responding to our notifications as they used to, which could cause delays in construction and scheduling foreign work. And so the team worked with legal to introduce a new process where we're seeing great improvement so far right now. So with that change and using this historical data to prioritize circuits, I think we're going to see a lot more reliability impact from our tree trimming efforts. And then additionally, Gold Bar 554 and Northbound 2514. You see Gold Bar is number one on the list. Northbound's not on the list, but it's still a pretty, there's not as many customers on that circuit, but it still has a lot of frequent outages. We're gonna do frequent spot trimming to those circuits due to its wildfire risk. So we'll see. Spot trimming, just, you know.
Oh, trimming, I thought you said training. I apologize.
Please go on. So we'll also, from that spot trimming, we're gonna see a reliability impact. With our outage location project, we had a summer student in system planning protection go through 6 years of outage data for our 5 worst performing circuits, and he manually identified the location of outages. So very grateful for him doing that. So with those outage locations, we worked with our maps and record group, and they created these maps that that showed the locations of the outages. And they use colored dots for the outage types, and they adjust the darkness of the dots for the bigger the outage was. So Once we got these maps, we were able to identify trouble areas with frequent outages, and so we can calculate the SAIDI that was contributed from those outages. We're also able to go back and look at the outage costs that were associated with those, and then also looking at the future, we can calculate the overhead lifecycle costs. So then the next steps would be to propose projects that where we can estimate the SAIDI reduction that project will provide. We're getting project cost estimates from our distribution team, and then from there we can present a benefit versus cost and risk assessment and decide if we can, if the project is basically worth it. So having these exact outage locations has been very beneficial for future project proposals.
So is that the Sky Commission, the upper one?
That is.
And what's the lower one?
Lower one is a Granite Falls circuit. This is Mountain Loop Highway.
Oh. Okay.
So this is still an ongoing project. I think we originally started this with the thought that undergrounding was, you know, our biggest goal, but there's also smaller scale projects that can be proposed. And so the value of knowing where faults are frequently happening is very important.
Is that, excuse me, before you go, that 32017, is that index or?
That is very close to, it's actually before index, that's right outside the Gold Bar town.
Okay.
And then we'll talk about SnowSmart, which will deploy hundreds of wireless communicating smart grid devices and replace an existing and aging SCADA system with a new modern system. So as we saw from the slide of our current reducing strategies, manual switching and reclosers is our best way to reduce SAIDI on a daily basis. So what SnowSmart's gonna do is really amplify this. So even without the communication, just naturally more reclosers and more switches on our system will result in less customers being affected by outages and more opportunities to restore our customers. But with the communication capability, our energy control center will be able to do this remotely, reducing the time it takes a serviceman to perform the switching. Additionally, this hundreds of wireless smart grid devices also includes our rollout of single phase reclosers in our high wildfire mitigation areas, which during off risk season will still also improve reliability. We're excited for that. And then with our SCADA and ADMS upgrade, we should see a better monitoring, alarming, and controlling of the system from a single interface for operational flexibility. There will be an outage management system and fault detection for our DA infrastructure. This will include recommended switching plans, taking into account the loading on the circuit, taking into account protection needs, and it will provide restoration steps with preferably the least amount of steps so it can be done quicker. We'll see better data for analytics, better visibility of our system for our field personnel. This will enhance safety for our field personnel to be able to see the live system configuration. And then in the future, we'll have a fault location, isolation, and service restoration application that our operators will be trained to use. Questions?
Oh, I do.
Yes.
So SCADA and ADMS, those are mainly software improvements, upgrades.
Yep.
And are they up to snuff right now? As good as we need, or do we need better in that area, or are we good in the software that we're using?
Right now, or that we will be getting? I think...
Is that going to be coming?
That's coming with SnowSmart.
Okay.
Any questions?
No, I'm learning a lot of new stuff.
Your lips moving, but yeah, here you go. So this is part of our $30 million grant, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So this is a big deal. It's going to let us do 20 years worth of work in a certain period of time. And so will it have the ability to like the custom map you showed us earlier of the circuits that the safety guy used.
Will it have some of that automated to look at those kinds of things in the future, or will it give us data like that as well as?
We're definitely going to have much better data analytics from the system, because every one of those new devices is bringing back points to our SCADA system. And so we have much more visibility now.
So can you monitor your voltages and
correct
all those kinds of things?
Yep.
Also,
okay. Yeah, we'll have much better data. As David mentioned earlier, Soren, right now we any outage that goes past a minute, we count as a permanent outage.
Mm-hmm.
The IEEE standard is actually 5 minutes. We have not adjusted because we didn't want it. It was, and you help me out here, David, it would be difficult to change on our current system. But we will likely change and update that to with the new system, with the new ADMS system, to 5 minutes. So we'll see a pretty significant drop, or hopefully improvement in safety. But then couple that with the continuing the DA or the automated switching, which that can be done in most cases within that 5 minutes. So that will also then eliminate those types of outages as well. And we can do it automatically.
Yeah, I think the coupled part is very important. And that's when I mentioned the future fault location, isolation, and service restoration application, which is basically it's going to provide a recommended switching plan for operators that they will review and they'll be able to execute. And so as long as that's done in 5 minutes, I mean, that's safety safe right there.
Right.
Is the, may I?
Yes.
Okay. The data analytics, is that done by you and your team, or is that done in IT, or?
We'll be using the data, our groups and other groups likely, but we're not the ones that, I guess,
analyze.
Well, it depends, I guess. Currently, right now, we do analyze. Yeah, go ahead.
Good answer.
Yeah.
Good morning, or good afternoon, commissioners. Yes. My name is Christy Serling, CIO. And great, good question. The IT team, the data and analytics team, does provide the reporting, analytics, data science, the structure of reporting to be consumed and used and analyzed by the various groups within DD and the people using those systems.
All right, so it's the team.
It's a team effort.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Questions?
Can you remind me when, what we're replacing and what year are we doing that?
So, new, automated distribution management system, that's the ADMS,
yeah,
that will replace the OMS system, as well as the SCADA system, and that's what Christy can give you a better idea. That's all part of the SnowSmart grant and
okay
project.
Okay, it's part of, all right.
Yeah, coupled with the device, the adding the devices out onto the system,
yeah.
But the timeline for the ADMS and SCADA.
Absolutely. The team's getting close to a final decision and reviewing best and final offers and looking
okay
at the potential finalists. You will see in the next several weeks a proposal coming to you for the vendor selection.
Okay.
And then from there, we would engage with the selected vendor, whichever one that may be, to do the deep planning for the scheduling of that actual project. But it's generally a three-year development cycle. There is a long cycle of designing the system, developing it, testing it. So within the 5 years of the GRIP grant, we'll see the system actually be realized and in place and cut over to production.
And keep in mind, that's coupled with the AMI deployment.
Right,
all that,
right, yeah.
You know, really, it's a part of that utility of the future.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Cool stuff.
Any questions?
I have no more.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great job, David. Sorry. That's it for presentations.
All right. Let's move on to item three, comments from the public. Are there any comments from the public on items not listed on today's agenda? Please state your first and last name for the record. I'm going to sign up cards. I'm looking online.
I'm not seeing anybody. I'm not seeing any hand raising. Okay, we'll move on to item four, our consent agenda. 4A, approval of the minutes for the regular meeting of July 2nd, 2024. 4B, bid awards, professional service contracts and amendments. 4C, consideration of certification slash ratification and approval of district checks and vouchers. I'll call for a motion. We're calling for the motion first.
Pardon? Oh, I'm sorry. Let's see. Hold on. I move approval.
Okay, so first we'll ask, are there any comments from the public regarding the consent agenda? If so, please raise your hand. I'm not seeing any hands raised. So, commissioners, do you guys have any questions or comments?
I have a question. On
Commissioner, you should, your microphone.
Oh, hello. Okay, I have a question about what is, this is on hydraulic model on call. My question is, what is that? Page 29 of 8. I'm just not familiar with that.
No, it's okay.
Hydraulic model on call.
Yeah, so Christina, our manager out at Water, we use the hydraulic modeling in our private developments and some of our capital improvement projects, fire flows, that kind of thing, so in order for them to actually move forward with their projects.
So what's the model? I mean, what does that mean?
I'd have to have my engineer get back to you on that piece. I don't use the model myself. I know it's a very high-tech piece of testing and modeling that they do, but we're trying to actually get a software system in-house. We've already had it approved and we're moving forward with that. So we're getting training for a couple of our employees so that they can actually do the modeling in-house and save us a lot of money, because right now it's costing quite a bit.
So it's software, it sounds like.
Yeah, it is.
Logging software, that's
it
what
is.
This is for.
Okay. And then on engineering services for Kayak.
Yes.
I think I may have missed something, but my question is, how did changing this project from one to two separate projects streamline the process? I mean, because you had to have new design, new.
Yeah, we did.
A lot of, let's see, it says you need, you had increased costs for BHC consultants relative to the need to create two separate sets of plans, excuse me, and specifications, along with additional time for permit support and a second engineer's cost estimate. So why is that considered streamlining?
I'd have to get back to you on that.
I'm just, you know, trying to understand.
I'd have to get back to you on that answer.
Okay. No. Maybe somebody else knows.
First, let me go back to the hydraulic modeling. Hydraulic modeling, I believe, and I am by no means an expert, but it's basically the modeling they do for water pressure and water flows to make sure that they have water pressure for fire hydrants and for
okay.
the house at the end of the line, building at the end of the line. That's what the hydraulic.
In the water division.
Yeah, yep.
Okay, I should have known this.
And I think the streamlining, and again, this is just a little bit of a shot in the dark, divided into two because of the timelines to get permits are quite long.
Yeah.
So it made more sense for us to devise a project around those timelines and instead of basically spending the money and then having to wait on the permits to try to streamline it so that the project could be run in along the constraints of the timelines.
Well, thanks. That helps.
That would honestly probably be the answer for that, but I can actually have our engineer get back to you as well.
Well,
it might be good to verify my
response. Okay, Commissioner, I that answer was sufficient for me, but.
I think, yeah, I kind of would like to know, but no rush. I trust that you made the best decision. Just wondering why.
Okay, great. So we'll get some more specification.
I'll get that for you.
In time.
Yeah.
In time.
Commissioner, I have.
Yes.
On page 28, the, what is it, a billing for the Woods Creek Hydro area. I'm just curious, the amount, why is it, number one, it's a sole source, which I'm curious about. And number two, why is this even coming to us? I don't recall what the limits are for material purchases. Here he comes. For some reason, I thought that this would not fall within the need to bring it to the board, given the amount.
Clark Lang, Contracts and Purchasing. I'll answer the second part first. Material threshold is $120,000. So it does exceed that. And then the sole source, we did Contracts and Purchasing, worked with the facilities to do a pretty exhaustive search of sources for a shelter that met their needs. And we ended up with a lot of different shelters, but nothing that met the goals. And I'm sure that Don or Jeff can tell you more about what those goals are.
So you didn't bid it?
We didn't bid it because we just didn't find any suppliers that
would
have been competitive. We would have been bidding very different picnic shelters. And we knew going in that all of them except for this one didn't meet the requirements. So.
Well, I think the investment in, oh, I'm sorry, were you finished?
No, I'm just saying there's a cost of bidding too, so I can appreciate that.
Correct.
Not
doing. I was just going to say it's long-term planning to have redwood because it's more resistant to insects and other things. So kudos. Okay.
Any other questions about the consent agenda?
I have none.
I don't have a question, just a comment. You know, looking at the Crosswind substation, it's nice to see that our bids are coming in lower estimates.
Wow.
I remember after the pandemic, it was inverted. Our estimates were constantly being exceeded, and so it's good to see that we got a lot of bids. And, yeah. Great.
Okay.
I will call for a motion, or I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Next is item 5, public hearing in action. Consideration of a resolution amending retail electric vehicle charging rate schedule 83. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
I'll now convene a public hearing. We have Christina available to answer any questions on the resolution.
Yes.
And we were thoroughly briefed. Are there any comments from the public regarding the resolution? If so, please raise your hand. I've not seen any hand raised online or in the room. Any questions or comments?
I have no more than we've had before.
I have no questions.
Not either. I will close the public hearing and I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion carries. Next is item 6, our CEO General Manager report. Can you report for us today, John?
I do. A couple items. Going to start with, I'm sure you all heard, or I assume you heard, that the announcement on the Columbia River Treaty that came out last week, and I'm going to have Kim Johnson come up and give a high-level overview of what we know, at least as of right now. Good afternoon, Kim.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Kim Johnston, Director of Government Relations. And as John said, I'm here to talk about last week's announcement that the US and Canada have reached an agreement in principle on the Columbia River Treaty, or to modernize the Columbia River Treaty. But before we get into those details, I want to just set the stage and do a high-level reminder of why this is important to us. So, the Columbia River Treaty, which was implemented in 1964, provided for the construction and operation of several dams up in Canada that doubled the amount of reservoir storage and helped significantly with flood control, both on the Canada side of the border and the US side of the border. In exchange for that, the United States did a lump sum payment, and we also agreed that we would provide Canada with what's called the Canadian entitlement, which is a transfer of power benefits up to Canada. Over time, that formula that's used and some of the assumptions built into that, they've just been outdated. which really means that we are sending power up to Canada in excess of the benefit that we're getting on our side of the border. So I want to bring this home for a quick second. As BPA's largest single customer, back of napkin math here, but the entitlement, US government has estimated that the entitlement overpayment is in the range of $300 million these days.
A year.
A year. So when we talk about our impact of that as BPA's largest single customer, 10%-ish annually falls to our customers. It's $30 million. It's a big deal. So that explains why we've invested a ton of time keeping this at the forefront of our delegation's mind and the need to modernize this treaty. So that brings us to last week's announcement. Now, I want to be clear, this doesn't mean that the treaty has been modernized, signed, sealed, delivered, but it is a really, really positive step in the right direction for progress here. What we know, and unfortunately, there's not a document on the agreement in principle. So I've spent the better part of 3 days in every meeting possible trying to understand what exactly is in this agreement. And so I'm here to share what I have learned in those conversations. I do want to point out, while it's not signed, sealed, and delivered, both sides of the border here, the governments, are talking about these things. So it's, while it's not done, it's a really significant step in kind of the roadmap that they will use to draft the modernized treaty. So with that, let's jump into some of what we know. There will be an immediate 37% reduction in the Canadian entitlement transfer to Canada starting August 1st of this year. And that reduction will incrementally step down until we see a 50% reduction by 2031. So that's significant. Hedging on a question here, I don't know exactly how that will translate to, you know, potential BPA rate reductions or decrease in operating costs, but we know that it's less money than we're paying right now, and that's a good thing. Power delivery will also be modernized to industry scheduling standards. So Canada can't deliberately choose when we decide we need to buy that power back from them at key moments to have us purchase that power at the most expensive moments in time. This is a big deal to power scheduling folks, and people are excited about that. And the agreement calls for the development of greater transmission connectivity between the US and Canada. Senator Cantwell in particular was a really big help here. She put an amendment in the IIJA bill that, gosh, I'm not gonna remember the acronym, but that was the big investment in Infrastructure and Jobs Act. She put a provision in there that really helped with these treaty negotiations to help on the transmission side, and we'll learn more about that in the coming talks.
So did that transmission to help enable Canada to sell us energy, or vice versa, or both?
Yes, and here's where, you know, I don't have all of the details yet to really understand how the mechanisms are going to work, but I think what I can tell you is that BPA thought that this was a good thing in our meetings with them, so I'm taking that at face value.
Gotcha.
For the time being. Regarding flood risk management, the US will continue to have pre-planned storage space behind the Canadian treaty dams, which basically means in most years things will continue to operate as they're operating right now. Particular importance to us, and one of my big concerns was, with one part of the current treaty is that flood control provisions were set to expire on September 16th of this year. And I was concerned that power customers were going to be on the hook to pay for flood control measures going forward at the point where those expire. Under the agreement in principle, we have been told that congressional appropriations will cover the flood control expenses. So that will not be borne by ratepayers. And this is significant. There's a couple of pools of money that they're going to pull from, but the estimates are around $54 million annually over 20 years. So we were very pleased to hear that Congress will be shouldering that versus the region's ratepayers. And then on ecosystem functions, the agreement continues and potentially further enhances flow augmentation for salmon migration during dry water years. Both countries expressed their commitment to coordinate on studies on salmon reintroduction led by the tribes and Canadian Indigenous nations. And it calls for the establishment of a tribal and Indigenous-led advisory board. So that's kind of the level of detail that I have at this point in time. Overall, I'm cautiously optimistic, but I'm also very aware that the details matter. So we're going to continue to try and parse out as many details as we can get and do all of the analysis that we'll need to really figure out what this means for BPA and for Snohomish PUD going forward. In terms of next steps, the agreement in principle will be the basis for formal treaty modernization. As I mentioned, some of this can be implemented now, like the Canadian entitlement reduction. Other parts of this are going to need to be drafted, and it's a large enough change to the treaty that it's going to be, will need to be ratified by the Senate, meaning it will need a vote on the Senate floor. I am very realistic that that is going to take some time. It's going to take time to draft this, to get both sides to agree that the words on the page match what they agreed to in the room in their conversations. Then it needs to start working its way in the politics through the Senate, and then a vote. It needs to pass by 2/3 majority for a treaty ratification. So it's a very positive step, but we have many steps to go in the process. However, it's taken us 6 years and 19 rounds of negotiations to get here. So I think it's a, I'm feeling, as I said, cautiously optimistic about where we stand today.
Any questions?
Do you think it's possible to get this through to the Senate before the election?
My personal opinion?
Well, this is a huge,
I have a question.
It's just depressing that something has happened.
Yeah.
That something has come out of those closed rooms, and it's, so it's good to hear the entitlement. That's a great first step.
I should take a moment just to publicly thank our congressional delegation. This has had bipartisan support. It's really hard to get bipartisan support on just about anything these days, but they have done a lot of work for us and heavy lifting to keep this top of mind for the administration, keep this as a priority, and pushing really hard, particularly with those flood control provisions expiring. Because that was worst case scenario. The flood control provisions were going to expire. We were going to have to pay under a called upon status for all of the flood control as things happened in real time, and we're paying for the Canadian entitlement as it currently stands. So this took a lot of work by a lot of people, and a lot of people here, and you all, lobbying and advocating for our customers when we meet policymakers. So lots of thanks to go around, and Senator Cantwell has been a true champion on this.
Yes.
So if you cross paths with her, be sure to thank her for her help.
I have a couple more.
Okay.
The 50% reduction, what was the target date? Was that 31?
2031.
Okay. Like January 23rd.
Yeah, I don't have 2030 on. There is a schedule by year that I hope will be public shortly that we can share at which point it is.
Well, I'm grateful for all of your department's work on this and you. And I would like to have you tell me again what you said about the tribes, the sovereigns. You read something about comments by the responses by the tribes.
Both countries have expressed their commitment to coordinate on studies on salmon reintroduction, and that will be led by U.S. tribes and Canadian Indigenous nations. And in the agreement, they're setting up an advisory board that will be made up of the same U.S. tribes and Canadian Indigenous nations to make recommendations on operations within the Columbia River Treaty.
Well, that's huge. I think the original agreement did not have much tribal involvement, right?
Yeah, you know, if you recall,
50 years ago,
Yes, when they originally drafted it, that was not at the forefront of folks' thoughts.
Right.
From, I think I'm getting these dates right, 09 to 2013, EPA and the U.S. Corps of Engineers did a lot of work to make a recommendation called the Regional Recommendation to the State Department. And within that regional recommendation, they stood up what we often refer to as the three legs of the stools for priorities for a modernized treaty. And that's ecosystem function, flood risk management, and the Canadian entitlement for power provisions. So
I think one thing that I think is interesting about why it has to go to the Senate is because it's a treaty between two nations. So
yeah, and if we had just seen some minor tweaks, then sometimes you can do things through an exchange of notes. I think it's, while it's not fantastic that the Senate has to vote on it, there were big enough changes that are being proposed here and worked on and drafted that it did meet that threshold, and the Senate has been very clear that they want to exercise that authority. They've been adequately briefed the right committees at this point, and so once things are actually written on paper, then the work will begin in the Senate.
And
at this point, we will continue to be very engaged on the importance and all of the education that we do around them.
Was the CEQ very involved in the negotiations? Council on the Environment?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if they were at the table or not. I can find that out.
There are a lot of environmental concerns on that river. Yeah, that would be interesting because if the administration changes, the CEQ will change.
Yes, if the administration changes, then
a lot.
There will be a lot of changes.
Yeah, yeah. I'm concerned about that. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Any other questions?
Any questions?
And no more.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot more about this.
Yes.
For months.
Yeah.
Hopefully not years. Here and in trade association meetings and across the region.
A huge lift.
And it was Scott Sims was very involved, right, in the negotiating process.
Yeah, so, you know,
representing the public utilities.
We've done a lot of work ourselves. PPC has been very actively engaged on this issue. And then we're a part of a group called the Columbia River Treaty Power Group, which has a lot of vested interests, and I meet weekly with that group and have for 5 years since I've been here. And we've done many trips back to DC again. And we've met with the White House, we've met with Department of Energy, the Corps, our congressional delegation. We've really put this as a top federal priority for us in the region. And it's showing through in this progress, which is great.
You need to cover this in your memoir someday. What's gone into this?
Maybe not.
Doesn't everybody write a memoir? You know.
Thank you.
Yeah, just to double down on the kudos, Kim and the team and a lot of our public power peers have really invested a lot of time. It is a big deal for us. Huge impact. Thank you, Kim. Also want to invite Jason Zaskowski up to talk a little bit about the impacts from the heat wave on our power supply and how we dealt with that, which was really overall very, very positive.
Yes. Right. Good afternoon, commissioners. Jason Zaskowski, Assistant General Manager for Facilities Rates and Transmission. As John mentioned, the event was really kind of a non-event, which is a good thing. Temperatures started to increase July 5th, and we hit 92 degrees on July 9th, so a five-day event there with temperatures steadily increasing. Three kind of hot days being the 7th, 8th, and 9th, and typically when you get 3 days in a row, that's when you really kind of tend to really heat a building up, or in a cold event, really cool it down, and that's when you really see the load kind of hit its peak. We did hit our peak load on July 9th, kind of about 8 o'clock in the evening. That was 1,112 megawatts, so pretty significant summer peak load. We were well prepared for it, and a lot of that goes to our new energy risk management strategy and our increased targets. So basically, we're going into the months with more energy and more capacity. capacity. And so that allowed us to then serve that load. From a market perspective, we didn't see a lot of, you know, really high market prices. On average, day-ahead prices were around $150 a megawatt hour. And some of the highest trades we've seen were around $300. So didn't see things get too out of hand there. And over the 5 days, we spent $88,000. So, you know, yes, much better than, you know, some of the things that we've seen in the past.
That number.
Yeah. That was a good thing. You know, overall, just the team did a great job preparing for it. Kind of saw it coming at our bi-weekly risk meeting, talked about it, talked about our position. We have lots of water in the Jackson Reservoir. The team's done a great job there, kind of forecasting that and getting that filled up. And then also our reservoirs on the Columbia. So we had a little bit of capacity there. We didn't dip into Jackson. We actually went out and purchased in the market instead of dipping into Jackson, so we can save Jackson for later in the summer. So good strategy, good execution by the team.
Questions for Jason?
No, it was something I was curious about, so thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yep, you're welcome.
Thank you, Jason. Just a couple other items I want to note from our ITS group. A team from multiple departments completed a significant upgrade to a couple core systems. The complex upgrade was a culmination of months of hard work. The team did a fantastic job planning, testing, and executing the upgrade. Team did such a good job that they were able to end a system change freeze a week early since there were no issues after the upgrade. The upgrade included our enterprise SAP solution, new current service packs, and ensuring enhanced performance and security, and an upgrade to our ConnectUp system. Customer and Energy Services, and we mentioned this a couple weeks ago or at the last commission meeting, but we've begun accepting self-attestation applications for the Washington Clean Energy Credits. Funded by the Climate Commitment Act, we have received $14.4 million to distribute with a maximum award of $200 per household. We anticipate reaching over 70,000 households by mid-September. An initial notification email was sent to 44,000 customers on Tuesday the 9th, targeting those most financially constrained. We received 5,800 applications back within 72 hours. Just a huge thank you to our energy services team, corporate communications, and government affairs for making this program possible. And then lastly, from our corporate communications and community engagement teams, this time of the year, the 1936 service truck is in lots of parades, and Zip and Zap are keeping very busy. A huge thank you to Commissioner Logan for driving the truck in the 4th of July parade in Arlington. I heard it was a phenomenal success and hit, and you didn't hit anything. Right?
I had no reportable incidents.
Thank you for that. We also had our ConnectUp folks out at the Sultan Shindig this past weekend handing out flyers and candy, announcing, and candy wins over customers in a big way, announcing that we will be deploying the AMI meters in their neighborhood soon. And our first of our four integrated resource plan listening session open houses will be on July 24th from 5 to 7 here at the electric building. And that's it.
Any questions for John or comments?
No. Congrats on making it.
Thank you.
Making it to
the end. Down the street.
Yeah.
4 miles an
hour. Well, your Falcon, I can't drive. I don't know how to drive a car.
Yeah, I saw that.
Anything but a clutch. So.
I saw that notice in the daily bulletin about volunteers to drive, and I thought, no way.
So you're stuck with it.
I loved it. I had this silly grin from ear to ear as I was going in. I've been on the parade three times, but this is, I got the most interaction when you're driving an Eagle truck and a lot of people come by.
Does it have air conditioning?
It doesn't even have heat. It's got three knobs on the dash, and none of them are for heat. The cooling is the front windshield folds forward, so you get a gap under the windshield. That's the...
Is that,
and at the windows.
Is that the way it was?
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
Probably works in a rainstorm.
It has one wiper blade, too. Just on the driver's side. So I'm glad it wasn't raining. So, yeah, it was interesting. I haven't driven manual in a while, and it
is actually very easy to try. A little hard to turn.
Okay, thank you.
So that's great news about the customer. So the money is going to go to customers, the 14 million. Is that mostly going to customers that are behind on their payments, or not necessarily?
I don't think that's okay. Necessarily. I don't. Yeah, John is here.
The other John.
Yeah, the other John.
Good afternoon, John Hoffman, Customer and Energy Services. No, so it is available by the household income. There's no debt requirement to qualify for the credit.
Well, okay, cool. Great work.
Okay.
We'll move on to item 7, Commission Business, Commission Reports.
Board of Commissioners?
I just have one thing to report. I went to the Arlington Street Fair this weekend and a wonderful positive comment from a member of the public, just noting how much more our communication with the public has been increased the last 2 years. She's very specific about the things that she has seen, and she said, I have a better idea about what's going on. And, you know, so.
Good.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Next is our commissioner event calendar. Are there any changes to the event calendar, commissioners?
No.
I don't have any. Well, I was late in getting back to Allison, but I'm going to do that safety days thing. Which
game
was it?
7. Okay. Next is item 7B. No, next is item 8, our governance planning. Are there any changes to governance planning calendar?
Yes, I do have a question. Will Cap and Invest consignment? Oh, excuse me, I had it covered up. My question, Cap and Invest consignment revenue allocation policy. Can somebody explain what that's all about? Cap and Invest consignment review.
It's on our list of items to be scheduled.
To be scheduled, yes.
Yeah. Jason Zaskowski, Assistant General Manager of Facility Trades. Transmission. So basically, that is the allowances that you know we get through the CCA, and then some of those we send off to auction. We have recently done some of that. And I think basically the policy around what are we going to do with those funds. So that's what that discussion
okay.
Should be about.
Oh.
Okay.
Right. Thanks.
Do you have any questions about the governance planning calendar?
I have no questions, but I do sincerely appreciate that we will be doing that special meeting on the 1st on the BBA product analysis.
Yeah.
That will help me tremendously.
I think that will help us all, the deep dive into that.
I hope that's going to be recorded.
You don't record our special meetings.
I'm going to be in Michigan.
Uh-huh. But you'll attend remotely.
I'm going to try my best. I think I should.
Oh.
We have it arranged, so
we'll get you set up.
It's important. That.
Yeah, this is a huge decision for the utility.
Yeah.
But you will be able to do it virtually.
Yeah, there is Wi-Fi at the cabin where we'll be on the lake. But you know, it's been good. They've had good Wi-Fi.
Oh.
So I expect to be able to join them. I'll have to make sure I've got my time change figured into that.
Okay, good. Is there any further business to come before the board today? Okay, hearing none, it is 2:44 p.m. and our meeting is